Forge the Narrative.
Hey everybody, welcome to Forge the Narrative. My name is Paul Murphy, your host of the Alabella Lost Souls podcast. I'm joined tonight by Chris Morgan.
The dynamic duo.
Hey Chris, thanks for joining me.
Yeah man.
Got a lot of stuff coming up. Got the Louisville Slugga coming up. That is June 9th and 10th in Louisville. I mean, I know I've said it before, it is called the Louisville Slugga, so you can figure out where it is.
Yep, for sure. I mean, and are you giving away a Slugga as one of the prizes?
Oh, if we could find one. If we could find one. We are going to have some cool prizes. This is going to be the first time that you can get the FTN trophies produced by Shapeways is going to be at the Louisville Slugga.
Oh, yeah. I'm excited for that. That's cool. Those are real neat looking.
Oh, they are. I'm going to try to paint them up too, and then we'll do some more spots with Shapeways about that whole process, about how it was created and how people can get their imagination into something physical, which, you know, even 2 or 3 years ago, I don't even think was possible.
Yeah, I would definitely say it's with 3D printing on the rise. I mean, at Adepticon, I picked up a 3D printed robot for my boy, you know, and having that accessibility and just like, It's cool. There's no version of this that isn't cool.
Yeah, agreed. The other big tournament is the ATC. So that's the 5-man team tournament. One of the largest tournaments in the world. There's going to be tons of teams there. 500 people playing 40K.
Yeah, that's a big party.
And other stuff. Underworld Shadespire is going to be there. They're doing a Sigmar team tournament. I mean, it's a massive event. They've brought it out. Extended it to a full 3 days. Shane and Chris, those are the two main organizers of the event. They do an amazing job. I can't remember if they're sixth or seventh year, but it is something that I look forward to every year, and that's coming up in July. I think that's July 14th and 15th, if memory serves right now.
Well, you know, we talk about ATC every year on the show, and it sounds like it's getting bigger, and it was already huge.
Yeah, it is. So those are the two main things I've got coming up, and I'm most excited about right now. And the Louisville Slugga is something that we are hosting, FTN, along with the Bourbon Brothers there. They are some of the ones responsible for the scene being active and thriving in Louisville. And I'm also writing the missions for it, like even as we speak. I've got 3 missions done right now. Going to be 2 more. It's a 5-round tournament. You know, I wanted to wait until we saw the big fact come out, in case that was going to change the dynamic of the game and what most people take. Because that's really what you know. I'm a big believer in the fact that you can balance the game through mission design and point limit. You know?
I'm a believer in the fact too. Maybe that's not what you meant. But no, I was actually just gearing up to ask you, like, how different does your mission design feel post FAQ? What are the things that you had to think about differently?
That is a good question, and I think it's fortunately very subtle. And then I like to play to more of an aggressive style, so the missions are about things like killing, exposing yourself to potential extreme strikebacks and that kind of, but all in very fun. It's it plays into what 8th edition is all about, these missions will. And I think the FAQ helped hone that even more, like what the intent of 8th edition is. And so I think it kind of goes hand in hand with the idea of that, to make these missions to give an enjoyable environment for a weekend of gaming.
Very cool.
Yeah, and it's not that, and it's just a different way of playing. You know, there are lots of strong mission sets out there right now, and even the main rule book has wrapped in some elements that have been out there in the tournament scene for a long time.
And the progressive objectives and stuff like that.
If you want to hear the sound of someone tooting their own horn, you got to.
I always count on you for that.
I'm very proud of the fact that they've worked their way in, and they also were in the Horse Heresy books too in the missions.
Definitely, yeah, and it's very interesting too, because the way that I would say both of us like to play is we like to play up close and personal and in your face, except when you're bringing 3 mana cores. But that's less up close and personal, but. Even so, like with your missions and with, you know, a lot of the concerns that people are having online have to do with, well, now it's Gunline 40K again, which might be a bit premature. Maybe it's just, you know, Assault is now turn 2 and on 40K. We'll see. But when you're designing those missions, are there things that you're doing to try and get people up close and personal, like closer.
Well, not gun line. I shouldn't say not gun line. Gun line, I want every, the idea is to have every army be viable, but to present different challenges to where if you are facing just what is your polar opposite, your worst absolute matchup, then maybe you can play the mission and you can still do well in that round. You can still win that round. And that's what I think the mission should encourage, is not just non-interactive 40K. What I want is interactive 40K.
I think that's what everybody really wants too. And I know that's the intent behind the FAQ in general, is that they saw a group of people who were just like, turn one, my opponent goes first. He has a great game and I just pick up models, you know, that's kind of the mentality that they talked about on their live stream. And so, you know, missions are kind of the only way that we still have to kind of take control of what happens, at least if people are playing it, right?
Yeah. And I believe you publish that stuff as soon as you possibly can, so people can view them, make, if they want to make any changes to their list, if they want to include one more unit of deep strikers or one less or whatever, you know, that's the kind of thing that you want people to know in as far in advance as possible, so they don't show up on tournament day and be like, what do you mean I can't, you know, I'm not going to do well in mission three. If I'd just done something different, I would have done all right.
Yeah, we want people to bring hard lists too. We just want people to be able to enjoy the game more with the stuff that they like to play versus what they feel they have to play to win all the time.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah. And your question is like, what's the mindset? It is just, how do you encourage that interaction, that what 40K is about? The core concepts, taking and controlling, eliminating models, making it seem fresh and really enjoyable. Really, because you're going to be playing some hard games, like especially if you're in contention for winning one of the major awards, you might have some tough games, but how do you make it fun? And that's really what this is all about.
Well, you got to make it fun for as many people as possible too.
Yeah. Yeah, agreed. So those are the main concepts. And, you know, and so the FAQ, the big fact did kind of like zero down, get more honed towards the intent, like we just talked about. But it is kind of subtle outside of those big changes that seem to really be directed at Blood Angels.
Oof. You hit close to the heart.
I know. I couldn't make it through without saying something about it. But we're past those types of changes. The other changes are all either clarifications of intents of things or just restating of what it said in the rule book before. But then, you know, that rule of three is a huge change. I mean, I know plenty of people out there with four mana cores that they were taking in a detachment, or, you know, four units Dark Reapers, for instance.
High Fleet Hive Tyrant is out of business.
And so that does shift things, and so you don't have to plan for those. So, and that goes both sides. It's in the mission design and your own army list. Like you don't have to plan. You know, Mortarion is not going to die in round one of every single game you play anymore.
But if he does, it's going to take the majority of your opponent's army to do it. And if he dies to the combined might of the entire enemy army, he's still kind of doing his job, because everything else that you have in that list that does work is, you know, unscathed.
Yeah, moving up. And you've got to factor into the fact that a lot of people are going to like enjoy the fact that they have a round to assume board control. And that's something to think about with missions, whether you want to reward that or whether you want to make that more challenging, to where how big of a fact, how much you want that to play into the result of the game, of people just wanting to do that.
You know, I've been trying to take the Bear Grylls approach to list design. You know, improvise, adapt, overcome.
As a drink pee?
Sometimes it feels like you have to, honestly, if you're staying pure Blood Angels. I've been brainstorming a lot. I have an article that's going to come out in Frontline that's about that, just kind of brainstorming what things I need to do now with my pure BA list. And, you know, I've said it before, I like the pure faction lists, and I accept the limitations that come from that competitively, because that's kind of the standard I judge myself by. But it has been fun, and it's been entertaining and exciting to kind of open up these different options I hadn't been considering before. And I hope that we can see a lot of that moving forward with the different list design.
I think we will. And it's going to be interesting to see these brand new codexes that are coming out, and how to approach them with what is this now I hate to say modern when the game being as young as it is, but this new mindset.
Yeah, it's a living rule set. You got to kind of, you know, come in with the tide and leave with it too.
You know, I think that it will settle down though. I think that we're starting to see a little bit of change fatigue.
I don't know. That might just be because we've had a couple weeks of Sigmar.
I don't know. I think that that the idea of, well, you know, you're fact proof if you just don't exploit things. Well, what is an exploit? You know, like, that's relative. It really is. I think that we're starting to experience like a little bit of change fatigue. But my answer to that is that I think that's going to settle down, like, especially once all the codexes are released, because then we'll have the idea of everything that's out. We know everything that's, we know what's broken. And I'm using broken in the gamer slang version. We know what's powerful. And we know it's sure. supposed to be powerful. Like, I believe there should be strong units. There should be really bonkers things that everyone can do, because those things are often fun. How game impacting they are. I mean, that's, you know, if it's too much, of course it's too much. But sometimes it just feels like it's too much and it's really not.
Yeah. Well, and when you think about after the codexes that have already been announced, the only two heavy hitters that readily come to mind that are left to come out are Space Wolves and Orcs.
Yeah.
There's probably a couple others out there. I mean, we know that the sisters are coming because of the cool Adepticon announcement. But
that's going to be a fun thing to show people. I think that's really good. They're really going to illustrate
the process. Yeah.
The whole process of, like, okay, when someone asks for something, what does it really take to get it on the table? And it's not just somebody sculpting a miniature overnight and then putting to sure. a press and, you know, whatever. It's a multi-year process.
Yeah, for sure. No, I'm all about that, and I'm excited to see how that pans out. And especially, there's so much I have to say about a Sisters release coming, because the literature out there for them is really good.
Yeah,
it's agreed. Really good, and it's an exciting thing to talk about.
Yeah, 2 years ago, our Adepticon theme was based off of a story that appeared first in the Sisters Battle Codex back in second or third edition.
You're talking about the one from last year? The one with the Centurions?
Yes. Yeah.
Yeah. Because 2 years ago, we were playing Eldar together, Paul. I know that you try not to remember that. But
well, two Adepticons.
I was like, that wasn't inspired by Sisters.
two Adepticons ago at this point. No, that wasn't inspired by Sisters. But no, it was but speaking to their literature of how interesting it is. So you know, people dig it, and you know, I know people are going to get what they want. I mean, think about it. If your models are the last to come out, they're probably going to be gorgeous. I mean, think of the advances.
Yeah, for sure. They keep setting a real high bar with that.
Yeah, it's gonna be good times. So I guess leading us back to the original point, two big tournaments coming up. How do you prepare for them? Like, what does the FAQ do to you? And it's making a big difference in our ATC planning, because with the ATC you have to be cognizant of factions. So everyone, you can only use a faction once.
Right, and it's correct me if I'm wrong, but it's mono faction for the one player. Or can you have like a allied?
Oh, you can have an attack. You can have an allied. So you can have, you know, Eldar and Drukhari in the same list, but no one else can take Eldar or Drukhari.
Okay, so it is pretty much like exclusive like that. It's like,
yeah,
one person gets to claim them, nobody else does.
Yeah, that's right. Before we get too far here, probably too late, but Chris and I are going to do a short-ish segment, and then I've got a spot with Michael Chenal from Cool Mini or Not, where we talk about the Song of Ice and Fire game that's coming out from them, that Kickstarter. It is based off of the books Song of Ice and Fire by George R. R. Martin.
Okay.
So it only uses the books as a reference material for the game. I think the storyline and the campaigns and what have you are going to be drawn right from the books. And they're going to have an organized play kit that comes out at the same time that the model's going to wide release. And so that's cool that they've got that as a focus. But he'll talk about that. We can talk about our passion here, 40K and Sigmar, actually. I planned out my Edeneth Deepkin army.
Oh, man.
Yeah.
Codex Fishmen in the flesh.
Yeah. I mean, they've got a really cool story behind them. They actually have to go out and harvest souls it's kind of neat what they've done, and they're in the Order faction, so it's kind of neat how the like the Daughters of Cain and these soul harvesting soulless elves, as it were, are the kind of the darker side of Order, but yet they have a lot of the bright colors.
Order just got a lot more edgy with these last two factions.
And you know how I play? I went with all the aggressive bells and whistles stuff. Like in my list, I've put a lot of the eel riders, the water snake riders, and the shark riders. In there's an ability, one of the characters has an ability to teleport himself and two other units to the other side of the board, and then buff a unit's ability to charge. It's pretty aggressive.
Well, it's definitely a distinct faction in all of Sigmar. Just like the looking at it from an enemy perspective, where I've got, you know, the only Sigmar book that I really own or care about is the Carriage and Overlords, and I can only shoot at the one that's closest to me, and that sounds obnoxious.
Well, this is a unique, and like the Caradon Overlords, this is completely unique to Sigmar.
They've definitely done a lot to try and distance themselves from their old high fantasy style that's more, dare I say, Tolkienish or Tolkien based, since they already have a Tolkien game that's supported, right? So this feels so much more like they're owning these concepts. But
more importantly, there are 10 other companies that also have a similar token-based fantasy game.
I think 10 might be a bit conservative.
Yeah. So, but this is, I mean, they really are pushing it to be a unique, flavorful game world. And I mean, whatever, I'm buying in. I mean, that's, you know, I've got the Sylvaneth, which to me also have a unique flavor to them. And now I'll be going in with this Deepkin. I'm looking forward to it. I want to charge people with snake riders. I wasn't able to get one of those giant turtles in my list. I'm kind of disappointed about that.
Oh, yeah?
I think with they get tied on points. They're one of those, I think it's ultimately going to be a smallish figure count army.
Interesting.
So once you start putting everything in, and I went with the Eidolon, that's their god avatar.
Yeah, no, that's my favorite model from their range.
Oh, it's absolutely beautiful. And this is just in the army list phase or whatever. But I think you're going to have to choose whether or not you want one of the turtles or you want the Eidolon in a list by the time you take some other things. But one of the neat things is that those Sea Snake Riders, the Eel Rider guys, become troops. They what is called battle line in Sigmar, but they become battle line if you take like the king that rides a seahorse.
Yeah, those sort of things remind me so much of the like kind of the glory days of 5th edition, where you had independent characters on 40K who could play with the one four-sword chart we got to play with at the time.
Yeah.
That kind of stuff is fun to me. It's nostalgic.
So I'll definitely be throwing up some stuff on Twitter at warmaster_TPM as I start to get the stuff assembled and paint it, because they're beautiful models. I'm going to try to make them bright-colored.
Yeah, you gonna go for it?
I'm gonna try. You know, it's
one. You do of a lot of earthy tones, so
yeah. I mean, it's so difficult to like not have. Well, for me anyway, to not have the bright colors just seem like they're painted on. You know, to try to make it look like it's an organic, brightly colored thing, I think is going to be a struggle for me. But you know, whatever. There's a bunch of tutorials out there.
I think it must be said, Paul, that in any eventuality, any colors on those are going to be painted on.
That is true, but it just can't look, you know, it shouldn't look like it's painted on, unless that's what you're going for. Yeah.
Artistic license.
I worked on my buddy's Necron list this week again. I've been painting those Necrons. They go really quick. Like this is more of a figure supply issue that he's got. Like I have painted everything he has brought over except the Monolith, because I told him he's never going to play with it.
That's it's so sad, isn't it? I mean, well, the Monolith. Well,
now when you think the Tesseract Vault and Tesseract Arc got way better. So,
oh, by no stretch of the imagination am I saying that those suck. It's just the Monolith was the iconic Necron vehicle for so long, and it feels like forever since I've actually seen one.
Yeah, I could be wrong. Maybe there are some uses that I just haven't fully explored yet. But once you start throwing in 10 destroyers and 10 wraiths, you get real point thirsty.
Ugh, 10 wraiths. I hate it. I hate it already.
I think once the Deceiver model gets put in the list, and that is in like the list we've got, he'll lose a couple of destroyers and a couple of wraiths.
Yeah, for sure. I really like the Deceiver tactics.
Yeah.
It's, and the model itself, while it's a bit dated in comparison to the other sort of epic things that are in 40K right now with the newer sculpts and designs and things, it's got a lot of potential for customization. So
those things are out of stock everywhere. And so if there's anybody out there that has a Deceiver they want to trade or needs to be cleaned up or dusted up and they're not going to put in their list, let me know. I can get it to this dude and put in his list because he doesn't even have one right now or it would be painted.
Yeah, I saw one go up on the barter bucket like live, right? That it was $20 for the Deceiver and $20 for the Nightbringer. And I was like, man, I wish I had $20 right now.
Well, if anyone out there has a spare one, please hit us up on Facebook or on Twitter or whatever. I'm sure we can try to work something out. But he found one. He's like, I found one, but it doesn't have an arm. Can you make it work? I'm like, no. That model has no scale equivalent. There's no arm that's going to look good on that dude. No. and I'm not going to have you shopping it or showing it around to people and saying that Paul did this.
Oh, so it's your reputation on the line, huh?
I mean, I guess I can figure out something. Use the tentacle maker to, like, you know, put out a hose or something. But nope, did not want that.
It's just, you know, give him a Demon Prince arm. It's like, this is my strong hand.
Yeah. But I did, paint up the Warriors went up super quick. Did the Scarabs also super quick, left them on the sprue, painted them on the sprue. I might have said that already on the show, and I apologize if I have. But
you're talking about that.
Painting the Scarabs on the sprue went, I mean, I'm talking about like 30 minutes at 15 bases of Scarabs done.
Mm. Now, see, me, I'm painting a ton of Infinity models right now, and those do not paint fast.
No, I can imagine not, especially with all the lenses and stuff like that on them.
Lenses and buttons, and like they've got so many buckles and pouches. I don't know what they put in all of these pouches.
Just turn into Necrons. Necrons have no buckles and pouches.
Mm, it's becoming more appealing every day. Bring this guy. Oh, yeah, here are your Infinity models. These look like Necrons.
I know we talked about it. And look, and I'd be painting this army for him, even if they weren't what I consider fairly easy to paint. They lend themselves to, you know, the cheater techniques that we've talked about over the years of finishing moves of, you know, dark color, dry brush a light color. In this case, the darker metal, dry brush a lighter color metal. A single edge highlight on a small armor piece. Yeah, and if you want, you could get a little crazy with a recess wash of whatever,
or glaze or something.
Yeah, right? Glaze, right? Yeah, this lends itself to really pop it up. And then the bases, you know, we talk about quick way to do interesting and dynamic bases, and it really just all comes together with the Necrons. Like if you want to paint a 2,000 point army in a week, this is your jam. This is what you need to go to. There's actually the stores or some hobby stores used to hold painting competitions of you buy like a battle force and then you have 3 days to paint it or something. The money is always on the Necron. Like get the Necron, buy the Necron battle force, paint it, and then use whatever the prize is to get whatever you really wanted.
Well, and then you have plenty of extra time to paint other things after you finish that one 2 weeks before everybody else does.
Yeah, yeah. I think it's like a, I don't know if people are still doing it out there, but that was a time-honored technique of how to win the store painting contest. Show up with a finished Necron force that looks like the Necron force is supposed to look like.
Yeah, and then the Harlequins player is just rolling his eyes at you the whole time.
Well, he made a poor choice. Oh, can't wait for the Harlequins to come out. I know we're jumping around in a little bit of topics, but I'm practicing for an ATC game. And with Rule 3 and all that kind of stuff in effect, and still trying to take a little bit different take on the Inari list, especially after, like Shining Spears, what people used to do with Shining Spears, and I say used to do, what people did up until a couple of weeks ago with Shining Spears was drop in the Shining Spears with a stratagem, quicken them so they move in advance and then charge. And so they're able to get real deep into back lines, tie things up, hit things that would have never been hit were they not able to do this.
Right. I mean, that was basically the main gimmick behind the list that won the LVO.
Yeah, it's incredibly strong because in a lot of these armies, like an Imperial Guard line, for instance, they have the string of things that you have to grind through, or you just jump over them. And then you get to touch their tanks, and then their tanks don't get to do anything for a round or two. at the minimum a round or two. And so, but with Quicken not doing that anymore, I find Shining Spears a lot less appealing. So I went with a little bit different of a makeup. This list I had, and this is just, this is not the final end of the list, but it was a Yunari list, because Yunari's still cool, with several Wave Serpents, three units of Dark Reapers, one fat one and two little ones. I think that's the standard configuration that we'll see now. I took two 20-man units of Guardians with weapon platforms, because sometimes just shooting a lot of shuriken pistols or shuriken catapults will do tons of damage to things.
I mean, it's great to, you know, just throw irony in people's faces. Oh, you're outnumbered by Eldar.
Well, then you never know when a soul burst, like a quirky soul burst might work on something, you know, to get it to do something it wasn't going to do before.
Wasn't this a dying race?
They're still dying. One fact at a time. Eventually be ground to the bottom of the solar system.
All I'm saying is Beltan seems a lot less fractured than they made it out to be.
All my stuff was Beltan. I'd say everything was it's like we never left. We just added that. But I added a solitaire to the list.
I really like solitaires.
He does his blitz attack. I mean, he moves a long way. He gets 10 attacks. He got negs to saves. He's doing tons of damage. He's got a 3+ invulnerable save.
No, I love sneaky little bullies like that. It's one of my favorite things about Mephiston. It's just he's this one model that can come in and just ruin somebody's plan and get somewhere to hurt somebody.
Yep.
Yeah, I love having that kind of. I don't want to call him an assassin, right? Because there are assassins for that sort of thing. But they are that sneaky little knife thrust.
They're a heat-seeking missile. That's what they are.
It's a wrench in the works.
Yeah, they're an actual hunter-killer missile that works.
the one that isn't Gulliman-dependent?
Oh, guys, it was this game that I played is not not indicative of how things that most games are going. I was actually playing against another stout list of Magnus, three Helldrakes, Ahriman on a disc, a couple of Demon Princes. He had some Nurglings, and he had a big fat unit of Plague Bearers. It was a neat list. I did enjoy it. And then I just couldn't get him to fail Magnus saves.
And I have a magic power that people may not know about, but it's the power to bless my opponent to make all of the invulnerable saves.
Oh, you need to make 7 4+ they need. In a row?
Yeah.
Go for it.
Yeah.
Do it. And of course, I don't think it was too far out of scope, but it's in the fact that if I just put one more wound in that guy, why didn't I put one more wound in that guy? And then in the round two, I just kept cursing myself as like, I could have fired my serpent shields. Like, he'd already be dead right now if I just fired my serpent shields.
Such a noob.
He had one wound left on him. My solitaire, who I blitz and goes over and charges him, doesn't kill him.
Now, isn't that just
he makes like
the
7
worst.
4+ saves. It was really depressing.
Even when you like someone a lot, like they're your good buddy and they're across the table from you.
He is my good buddy. And then he makes like a 11-inch Plague Bearer charge to wreck over my whole strategy on the other side of the table. I'm like, this is not how I envisioned this. This is not how I drew it up.
You just sometimes you look at them like you hate them. You don't really hate them. And you know, you're torn between feeling so proud of your friend. It's like, oh man, great role, man. That sucks.
We were helping each other along the way. Like, go here because you're going to want to consolidate here. You're going to want to do that. You're going to want to do this. But it's still, when it came time to roll the dice, like he still got that long charge and Magnus still sloughed off a blitzing solitaire and all the Dark Reaper shots that went on him before to get him down to that one wound. God, it was so miserable on my side. I played Val. Two days
before. How did that go? There was plenty of smack talk
involved
there.
That was all smack talk. He won the game.
Oh, Paul.
Well, I didn't
Good know. Job, Val. Good on you. I know you're out there. I give you a good pat on the butt.
He played flawlessly. There's no question about that. We were playing the ETC rules, and they use a combination of progressive objectives, which, again, you're welcome, and... You're welcome, Europe. The tactical objectives.
And interesting.
Those, you know, that's a very much a system of the rich get richer and the poorer get poorer.
I've never, I'm full stop. I've never enjoyed the randomness of tactical objectives.
I mean, it's all, it's great when like you're drawing equal numbers of both useful and non-useful things. But when you are player, let's call them player P. let's say you're player P and you draw 11 cards and you can score two of them. And your opponent scores 11 cards and he can score, nine of them. You're rowing upstream. That's
yeah. No, that's one of the for beer and pretzels, whatever, right? But for a competitive setting, not a fan. But hey, whatever people have fun playing, they're gonna play.
And beer it was, or at least something like that. Val being a guest, he did not have to do anything of the sort, but he did bring over a bottle of whiskey. And let's just say on that, after I drew those 11 cards and couldn't score anything, I was like, you know what? It's time for the whiskey. So my day went just fine.
So I'm happy for you.
My Dread Knight did kill two shield captains in Celestine and a unit of the bikes. He was
How did he feel about the Grey Knights?
The Grey Knights. The troops only had a unit of a strike squad and then the Dread Knight. And he did not respect them at the beginning of the game. He did not. And a lot of this has to do, he had one, some officer. It was three wound officer sitting back in an objective. Like, I'm just going to deep strike over here and fire my dudes. And you're going to kill that guy. All right. And I'll charge him. I'll charge him. I'll smite him once. Then I'll shoot. And then I'll charge the guy's going to be dead. I want to be over there near that objective. It's going to be great. Well, smited, charged a shot, failed the charge, and then forgot that I had a psi cannon on the unit. Okay, that was after booze class one.
Oh man!
So he's just over there. He's on the objective, and I charge him and fail the charge. You know, so he scores that point. And like, oh well, that's my bad. It was. That's one of those things. I'm just kicking myself. Like, if I just shot the psi cannon, then he has one wound left at this point. He's not going to have that wound anymore. Hopefully, with the psi cannon. With this guy's five plus armor save or what have you. But then it becomes, you know, it's that game of physics. Like his goal there is to not be some military commander of telling people what to do. His goal is to just be a piece on the board that's racking up points. That's his job. Then he can do it because it doesn't take long.
Caiaphas Kane strategy.
Yeah, and it doesn't take long for him to close out my five dudes over there because he then gets to come in with his scions and bust up that strike squad.
I gotta admit, I love scions. I think that they're really cool.
Beautiful models. Yeah, they're awesome.
Cool tricks.
Yeah, definitely cool tricks. Very awesome. So the Dread Knight I bring in on the other side. Because he's got those two shield captains. Celestine's over there. And I'm thinking, you know, what's the worst that can happen? So that's it. I charge a shield captain. Celestine intervenes. And I beat the shield captain down to one wound. I split attacks, actually. Put a couple of attacks on the shield captain. And then put a couple of attacks on the other bike squad that had come in. Because he used the stratagem.
Oh, that stratagem. Yeah. I'm going to charge your charge.
Yeah. So killed a couple of those, after he got it. Cause he gets a charge first. He didn't do any wounds. No, he did. Sure. He did a couple of wounds, to the Dread Knight, but not enough. And then I swing, split the attacks, get the shield captain down to one wound, like thinking, crap, one wound shield captain. Should have just put more attacks on him to finish him off. And then the other side of it, I do take out, one or two of the bikes that came through because the sword does D6 damage.
Right.
So you can get pretty lucky. Celestine, who had taken some damage, either to some psychic powers or to the Gatling silencer that was on his arm, wasn't at full strength either. So they then turn on him, beat him down, and he's down to one or two wounds. And then they finally finish him off in the next round, and then I do the in-death, does duty end,
right,
and then kill the rest of them.
Attaboy.
Yeah. I mean, I'm talking like kill Celestine, kill the rest of them bike clowns, kill the shield captain. Like, everybody died over there. So that guy did what he was supposed to do.
Yeah, he's a champion.
Yeah. So we ended the game, and we ended the game with, he had three or four models left on the table. And I had the majority of all my tanks. I'm playing Imperial Guard with that one unit of Grey Knights. The majority of my stuff still on the table. Not the troops. There was a lot of naked troops, but the Sentinels and all the tanks and stuff were still alive. Now, he was doing a great job of locking them down. I don't want to make it seem like this was like a foregone conclusion, like when we left. But he had also scored 9 points from those cards.
Well, I wouldn't expect Val to not bring his A game.
Oh, he played great.
And you know, dice being what they are what they are. Cards being what they are what they are. But you know,
dude, when you're 11 cards, I just want to score half of them. Well, actually, I want to score all of them, but I'd like to at least be able to score half of them.
Right, but that doesn't mean at any point that you check out of the game completely.
Yeah.
You know, maybe three glasses of whiskey and you do. But
oh, it was three. Is three the limit? I held in there past that.
You know, I'm not so super knowledgeable about this. So
then we went and sat on my porch and smoked cigars. So really, everyone won.
I mean, that sounds like a good day of gaming.
It really was. Oh man. No, it was there's no begrudging his victory. He did win on not even just on paper, he won. Like that is the way that game was going to be played with those things, and we both accepted it going in. We had two decks. We drew what we drew, and that is just how Warhammer goes sometimes. I don't prefer that style of play with cards, with that much random element, because I feel when I'm running a game or when I'm running my army, I like to believe that my army has a mission, whether that's dictated by that mission, and it's something they can follow through from start to finish, a plan from start to finish, either way, that be to outwit my opponent, to maneuver them, or to grind them in the dust. Like I want to feel like that's part of the game plan.
Yeah. And even if I lose, I want to bloody their nose.
Yeah. Well, yeah, have something to, yeah. Even if I lose, I know that I did it while I was trying to accomplish what I wanted to accomplish.
Yeah, you want to walk away from a game feeling like that.
Yeah, as set by the mission. But these are all like, oh, let me just roll a die and see where I'm supposed to go. It's like if you were to, get an army van, you're a guy in one of those army trucks with all your dudes in the back, and your orders are to go across the street and do this. Well, halfway to you're getting there, you get a message from command that says, nope, just kidding, go somewhere else. Like, ah. and then
I wish Ricky and Troop were here for this explanation.
They say that's just normal. You should be used to it. but then you're like 3 minutes from your next objective, and they're like, nope, sorry, got to turn around, go back the other way. And I feel like that's what the Maelstrom of War type stuff does, and I cannot stand. I'll play it, especially if I like the people that are running the tournament, and that's just what they've chosen to do. I'll play it. You know, it takes a lot to run one of these tournaments.
Everybody has this different idea of what's broken. You know, whatever is, the unpopular guy's list in your local store. Oh man, that's so broken. Like there are so many different examples of traveling around to different metas and with the same list and being confronted with, oh, you brought that and looked down upon, and then somewhere else. So it's like, oh my gosh, that is so broken. Why would you bring something like that? Like this, everybody seems to have their own idea on what is broken. But when you're coming to a tournament, guys, please, like, don't hate on somebody for bringing something good as long as it follows the rules. Yeah. You know, if it's following the rules, it's not, even if it's really good, that just means that they're, good on them for taking it. Now they just got to play well with it,
Yeah. I mean, I think that said is doctoring up the environment to, when you are making changes to the environment, the ecosystem, as it were, you need an agenda. Like you as whoever is doing it needs an agenda. Like what issue are you trying to solve? What are you trying to make sure happens or doesn't happen? I think that's the takeaway.
Yeah, sure.
And if you can avoid doing things like Maelstrom of War, I would be happier.
Yeah, well, at least we know what we're getting into as long as the lists of missions are published in advance.
I promise you that the Louisville Slugger, there will be no Maelstrom of War.
All right. Well, we have you on record, Paul.
I can promise you that. If there is, that if something shows up that looks like it, I'm probably a pod person and you have the right to detain me.
Yeah, well, I mean, it's breaking your campaign promises. You'll lose voters.
Not if I admit to being a pod person. And I shouldn't say it wasn't fun. Like, if we had drawn, like, if he and I had drawn the similar objectives, like, similar types of things, then it would have been a much better game. But at the same time, he could have just outplayed me. I mean, like, what it really came down to was, well, what really came down was scoring 9 points from random cards in that one turn, and then me scoring none the next turn. Like, well, this is an uphill battle.
Neat.
After drawing 11 cards, that was the worst. So what's the perfect system? I don't know. Well, I feel like closer than that.
Hold on. Let's see. We need to just combine this one with your paint rubric rant. And then we just got, you know, they call it the grousing episode.
I know some of the ETC guys listen. Like, whenever they want to get it, their stuff, you know, functional, where other people might be able to duplicate, I should say duplicate it, but respect it. And I mean this in the nicest way.
This, you know, in the South where Paul's from, this is called the bless your heart speech. Yeah,
bless your heart with your little objective cards that you draw randomly every time that you don't let people stack the deck. I mean, like, go far as the Shadespire thing. Build your own deck. Build your own deck of cards, right? But here's some rules about how to build your deck of cards.
Yeah, I can only imagine the shenanigans that a TO would have to go through to police people to make sure that they're building their decks of cards.
Well, properly. That's the penalty. Okay, cool. You show up with two of these cards you're only supposed to have one of, you are getting axed. Your whole team, none of your points count, and it will flip your next two wins to draws or losses or whatever. I mean, that's the kind of level. You can get real biblical on people as far as punishments go, depending on, you know, how you want your tournament to go. But I'm just saying. Flipping random cards. Yeah.
40K with deck building.
Yeah.
You heard it here first.
Well, I'm cool, but if that's the way, okay, they seem to want to pride themselves on being a different brand of 40K than what 40K actually is, and I'm absolutely cool with that. There are things that we do and will make differences to all over the place.
Yeah, I think everybody's guilty of that, right?
Yeah, tournaments will say, well, we are real 40K, and you can't bring this Y, you can't bring that, you can't do this, and we're all just supposed to accept that they are real 40K and be fine with it. And I don't care. The game is modular. The game is ultimately modular and can conform to whatever it is that you need if you want to play the models.
And people want to show up.
Yeah. But if you're going to go that route with these cards, it just seems like you are just creating what is the potential for so many tables to have just this sopping, seeping fun sponge at every turn. Am I wrong? I mean...
Well, I mean, you're kind of preaching to the choir here. I already said I don't much care for Maelstrom stuff. So, I mean, if you're looking for someone to disagree, you're probably looking in the wrong place.
I just want to know if it sounds like I'm too charged, if I'm too excited about the outcome being one way or another.
I don't know. All I think now is that Val is going to be able to claim that he gave you, like, Maelstrom PTSD.
Oh, he played well. He really did. And it was a fun game, and then it was good use of his... He had a great awareness of the board state, and with the deployment zone that we had, some of my options were limited, and the one... And I shouldn't say that. I was going to say, the one mistake I made... No, one of the mistakes that I made... he was able to capitalize on, which kept some of my heavy tanks from firing in round two. And so that was good. I did have two primary psychers near one of my tanks just for that inevitable situation for him running a character over and touching it, so I could burn them down in the psychic phase and not have fallen back from that character, so then I could then shoot in the shooting phase.
Right.
That was satisfying when that happened.
I imagine that feels pretty good.
Yeah, that trick only worked once in that game.
Oh, well, I'm sure that felt pretty good the one time then.
I had it all lined up too, and the next one, my tank commander was gonna overwatch on fives. No, anyway, none of that stuff came to be. But what really did it was just getting so far out of reach on the objective cards. I would have liked to seen a way. Like, if were I to be building my deck, I would have put things. Well, I don't know what I would have put in there, but I would definitely not have put 11 things in there that I couldn't have done. But on the other side of that, if I was actually more familiar with the deck, I probably wouldn't have put some things in my list either that I knew wouldn't be able to accomplish a lot of the goals. Mm. So it's, you know, it goes both ways.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I believe this is pretty similar to a list that you've been playing with for a long time that involves, you know, Guard and Grey Knight allies and, you know, the Sentinels pushing up to kind of create some more of those barriers and things like that. And that, I feel like, is a pretty versatile list in several different gaming environments, right? It's because you've got that move out, you know, push up in the early game, you know, creating that buffer. Sentinels are great for that kind of thing. You've got, of course, the reliable, cheap infantry. And you've got the dependability of the Manticore damage. You know, you've got some good tools in that list.
Well, I like it. The list is strong. It has won several tournaments, but they were more traditional tournaments with not random objectives that change every game, every turn.
Anyone else tasting something bitter? I'm tasting cranberries right now.
As we know, I just don't like it when the objectives change every single round.
Yeah. Well, it's frustrating. It is frustrating when you're in a game and you have to have something that does everything, but the tools that you have, maybe even in your army, don't exist to accomplish all of those very goals. But one of the big frustrations I had talking to a guy in 7th edition, I remember this conversation well. He looks at me and he says, 7th edition Maelstrom is the only way to play real 40K, and anyone who disagrees with me doesn't have any expletive. So that started an interesting conversation, as you can bet. And his strategy was basically this. When he built his list, he built it so that about 40% of your opponent's deck could no longer be used.
Yeah, okay.
And that was his list building strategy, and that's why he liked to play that, was because he had an army which could deny 40% of the deck.
Yeah, I mean,
not everybody has an army like that.
I don't know why you wouldn't do it.
Exactly. And how is that fun, right? When you're playing, at least on the non-Maelstrom side, right? When you're getting these cards, especially because he was one of those people who enforced the you can only discard once, you know, one card or whatever per turn if you wanted to. He would play that very strictly because he counted on people not being able to score against him ever. Because, oh, destroy a vehicle? Well, I don't have any vehicles. Destroy a monster? Well, I don't have any monsters. All I've
destroy
got
a flyer? No flyers.
Yeah, exactly. I've got all of these things. You know, the only thing that you could do, right, was like kill an independent character because there was no way of getting around that. But, you know, it was a lot of just stuff like that. And his games just ground down to, I've got a bunch of pretty much unkillable Necron infantry.
Yeah.
That
to take away us all the way back to the original of this about how do you make missions for tournaments? Not that way.
Right. I definitely would agree.
I joke to some degree. I mean, it is a large tournament and people put a lot of effort into it. Like to them, this is, you know, like their Olympics. And it's a big deal. I mean, people want to win, and in any system, you can find a way to play in any system. I did not game towards the system. I just was just taking a powerful list into the environment. And I happened to be on the bad end of an 11 card draw where I couldn't score any points. And that was an eye opener of like, how often does this happen? Were I to fly my little butt over to Croatia and have this happen, how would I feel?
Is that the ETC headquarters of Croatia?
But that's it. It's like if I were to be over there, that's enough about that. They have just a different style of play. But how neat is it that all these areas can have the different style of play and they're all thriving?
Well, it is great to see 40K on the whole thriving. And it's great also to see just, I think the hobby as a whole is doing really well. And people talk about 30K like 30Ks did, but I mean, you wouldn't know it from the 30K communities I'm a part of. Mm. It's only my local area that I would say that it's at least less common than it was, but it's not dead.
Well, because like 40K has so many people playing this game that they can make little tweaks here and there. And even if it let's just say it alienated 10% of the players, there could be, you know, still 100 million people on the other side of it that are going to be just fine.
Yeah, I don't think that it has to be like a mutually exclusive who wins, right? I think it's just a matter of, you know, what are you playing today?
Yeah, and you can think of every change as a zero sum game. You could do that, and in some situations that will apply.
Oh, yeah, for sure.
But some of the stuff, it does just lead itself to things winning. It's winning more often than they did, and so that's the kind of stuff that you'll see, and that's what we're like. I don't know that I can talk completely intelligently about what the new meta is going to look like right now. Without having too many large or even medium-sized tournaments under the belt, I think that our ATC list is shaping up to what I think kind of either meta craft or to already fit into something that's in the meta. We'll see how it goes. I think that with some of these changes, you can actually build lists because you have to have defenders and attackers in this environment.
Yeah, and you're talking about the Slugga, right?
No, this is for the ATC.
Oh, ATC. Okay.
Yeah, the ATC is where the idea was that you had defenders and attackers, and then someone was the champion, and the two champions couldn't be chosen as a defender or attacker, but at the end of the game or end of the matching, that the champions would play each other.
Sure.
Well, at some point, that became too exploitive, and so we've now gone to this. You put out everyone puts out two lists. To fight one list, and then the person with the one list picks one of those two lists he wants to fight.
Okay.
The Slugga, the Louisville Slugga, is a traditional five or one-on-one 5-round
Okay.
tournament. Yeah.
Yeah.
Which we do have. We've got shirts up for sale right now and dice for sale. You can find those at the forgesnarrative.net on the merch page. I have a shirt. I'll post a picture of myself up in a shirt pretty soon. And it looks good. The artist turned out really good. Goat Boy did the art. Fourth
He
Shift.
does have his particular style.
Yeah, and it works out great for this stuff. Fourth Shift Printing did the shirt printing, and they're the same ones that have done my Wrong Way Kid printing. They're the same ones that have done some other shirt printings for me. Just doing great work, easy to deal with, cool guys. We got some nice shirts. And it is a cool design.
Right on.
Pick up the dice, even if you're just curious, or get a t-shirt at events that sell t-shirts, and especially the ones that pre-sell t-shirts. And even if you can't come to the event, but you still want to support the event, buying some of this swag is like the easiest way to do it. You just put in the order, and then we mail it to you.
There you go.
And then it shows up at your house a few weeks later. As soon as it gets into our door, it's out to your door in a week or so. We get those kind of questions all the time. I'm not coming. Can I still buy a shirt? Yes. We want you to be there, but you can definitely still get a shirt.
Yep, you can wear the shirt during the same time as the event, and let your emotions travel through the warp in support the event.
Take some pictures. Be like, hold this event in three places.
Yeah, that mess a little bit with Google's online tracking. Just
So I love it. That scene up there in Louisville, it's a combination. It's got a combination of like real, pro tournament players, and then you got some folks that just want to be in the casual, the narrative style players. And so how do you bring them both together in a way that's going to be cool? I think the missions are shaping up to where that's possible.
I also like some of the stuff that we've started incorporating locally with some of our 2-day events and things, is where we're creating, the brackets, the day two brackets, where, the brackets have winners. So the people who are matched up together, who play that way, the people who play in a similar fashion are going to end up together,
Yeah.
on the second day. Everybody can feel like, you know what, for this bracket, among the people that I like to play, this is how well I did, and this is how I was rewarded for it. Those are really good ways to just reward people for enjoying the game as much as they can.
Yeah, absolutely. I told you, this is going to be the first opportunity to win the FTM trophies, the unique trophies from Shapeways for FTN is going to be at the Slugga. And then there's going to be a couple of the awards, the criteria of how you win them is going to be different. Like for at least two of them, just having a fully painted army is one of the criteria for winning the thing.
I love that. I love emphasis on the hobby. And it's especially cool because, you helped Reese with the ITC hobby track, and that's now live.
Yes, very nice. It's a really, really cool to see it all come together. And I want to be best Blood Angel next year.
Yeah, man. That's pretty much my goal all the time. We'll see how it goes. First, I got to get out of the house and play some more.
Well, it will be difficult, and that's what it is. This thing will be difficult. And I know there's that we could talk a whole section on that hobby track, but it's something that I think that once this gets completely up and going and accepted, that we will see certain tournaments that only want to run the hobby track as their ITC scores for that weekend.
And you know what? I don't think there's anything wrong with that.
I still think the net of it all is that you're still running more tournaments, and who cares?
Yeah, and it's going to bring out that audience of people who maybe they're a little bit more worried about that guy, even though that guy, you know, statistically speaking, is not as common.
Or he exists everywhere. Like, or yeah. He exists on the painting side. He brings some crappy painted stuff that he believes is Golden Demon quality.
Right. You know, or you have, you know, maybe there will be a new type of 40K controversy where the hobby track winner is the one who paid the best commissioned painter and didn't tell anyone.
See, I don't even care if you didn't tell anyone or not. Like, get the point. Get the points. I get it. But you know how he's going to win? He's going to win by taking that army to 5 or 10 different tournaments. That's how he's going to win. You know who's going to benefit from that? Those 5 or 10 tournaments that he went to, and everyone that got to see that army that gets to go home. At the first tournament he went to, and there was 50 people there. Those 50 people got to see that champion army and go tell who knows how many number of their friends that when they go to these things, they come back and they see this you see champion level armies at these tournaments. And so the next time somebody brings another champion army. So now you got 2 champion armies there, and then go back and go, man, between this year and last year, our champion armies doubled. We are on fire. Let's start making champion armies of our own. And then boom, hobby scene.
I love it. If it improves the hobby of the game, like I would love for people to walk into a 40K hall anywhere or everywhere rather, where they look at it and go, you know what? There's some real hobby on show.
Yeah.
You know, and not just the 1 or 2 guys who are always amazing. We all know who those guys are, because there's not enough of them, really.
They've got some natural talent that,
right,
that bleeds through past just their amount of hours that they want to put. Yep.
Yeah, one of the things, you know, about Adepticon that I heard in the 30K room, because 30K's always had a little bit, I would say, a little bit more of a determined hobby group in the Adepticon events, is that they go to the 40K room and they're like, it's okay. One of the things they said was how impressed they were with Sigmar's hobby showing, and how Sigmar blew 40K out of the water in terms of great paint jobs and cool tables and cool, just a great showing, you know. And people who wouldn't normally look at Age of Sigmar turned to that and said, hey, you know what? I would really enjoy that. And the secret to that, you know, the secret sauce to that was better hobby.
Yeah.
And if it gets more people to show up, I call it a win.
Yeah. I mean, that's it. That's really how this all works. You know, you can have it on that side, or you could have it be hate fueled. You don't want that guy across the hall there to get more points than you. So you've got to paint better. And then somebody else hates on you. They don't want you to get more points. And so they have to keep paint better than you.
Like, yes, whatever. Yes.
But the end result's the same.
Let the dark side of the hobby flow through you.
But where I'm going is that the end result is the same. Is that when all of this has happened, after the hate circle has come fully around.
The cycle of hate.
Yes. You still are left with 10 people with 10 beautifully painted armies that will attract who knows else, however else.
They have beautifully painted armies and scowly, angry faces.
Yeah, so who cares?
I'm not sure this is the greatest selling pitch you've given
Paul. Who cares if they bought the army? Who cares if whatever? Like, what you're doing is releasing it out there and into the wild. Like, hey, pro armies, beautiful armies come through here every now and then. Let's step up our game if we want to win these points.
No. Well, I mean, really, the showing of an army does so much to create the dignity of an event. The caliber, let's say caliber is the word I'm looking for.
Yeah.
Is that there are certain times where you go to an event and you think, part of my ticket price is wasted by the poor hobby showing that's going to be there.
Sure.
Right? You think, I showed up to play 5 games and I got creamed by 3 people with bare plastic armies. Like, why am I spending money on this? But I tell you what, that experience, even if you get creamed 3 times, but playing against a fully painted, beautiful army, it's a softer blow.
It is. It really is. There's nothing worse than, like, this guy painted his figures with a roller in his fingers, and here he is just rolling 6s. Ah, it's miserable.
Yeah.
All, but yeah. That is softened by, I don't care where he got it, eBay. Doesn't matter to me.
Yeah.
Just no,
I'm
see it.
I'm fully in, you know, speaking as a, you know, I would say I am a commissioned painter, but I'm definitely not an army painter, right? I paint models and squads and things for people, but the effect that it has on the players that I've seen who wouldn't have that normally, who now have something that they can play with and be proud of. I painted an Imperial Knight for somebody who got to use it right away, and it was, you know, an instant favorite model of his, and he really, like, his excitement over it, and he was colorblind.
Oh.
Right? So, or at least partially colorblind. And the joy that he had of having some cool stuff on the table, like, it made a difference to him. And that isn't to say that his own efforts were terrible. The fact that he shows up, you know, despite having that, the fact that he shows up and he at least always has the three color minimum, like, there's nothing to hate on about that, right? Mm-hmm. But the palpable joy that he had in having someone say, "Oh wow, that looks cool," that was really cool to watch. And he's a listener. He knows who he is.
That's cool.
But it was really cool to see him feel more excited about that. He's actually going to have me do something else for him here Very in the nice. Near future.
So the Slugga coming up is a total hobby experience. We'll be using Hobby Track if it's in a usable form, and BCP. You can actually register through BCP for the Louisville Slugga. We've had some registrants coming in through there. That is another way to do it right from the app. I believe, if I remember correct, you can do it right from the app. And there's going to be it's going to be a good mix of folks. It is going to be Party City. Yeah, that's this is going to be a really good time. I know there's going to be some activities that we do outside of just the tournament, and we'll have more announcements around those as we get closer to those dates. Anyway, where I was going, that's going to be a total hobby thing where the hobby track and the point track, the ITC point track, will be used. But on something like Battlehaven, I think Battlehaven, that is the idea, I think, and we're not putting words in their mouth, or I'm not trying to put words in their mouth, but I could easily see that being an environment to where they run an event, even if it's a small invitation event, like the guys over there in, what is it, SN? Over in Gibraltar.
Yeah, the Gibraltar SN Battle Reports guys.
Yeah, so where they run an event that has a bit of a guest list where it's only, like, the only thing that's getting reported are hobby scores.
Yeah, and one of the cool things about SN Battle Reports and their No Retreat Gibraltar event was when you buy your ticket, you have to send photos of your models because they have this standard. They're like, well, we are a Battle Reports site. Photos are an important part of what we do, and so the quality of the models that are on the table has to be respected. And the photos that come out of that are really cool. And there are people there, like, Tabletop Tactics went out there to play. So you know that there's people who go over there to play and have a good fun, you know, have a good time, but are also playing well, playing to win. And it makes it just adds so much to it, right? And Battlehaven has that potential, in my opinion, to deliver not only just a great gaming experience, but a great event experience.
Oh, those are good people. I mean, their heart is in the right place of putting together a real fun event. It's always nice when we get to chat with them and chat about the event. I just got me thinking, like, that would, I don't know the size and what the capabilities are, but that is an environment to where a tournament that just reported hobby scores would not seem out of place at all.
Absolutely. No, and based on my experience going there the last couple of years, you're going to see armies that will compete for that sort of thing.
Yes, that's great. I know we're rambling on a little bit, and we got that segment coming up after us, the Sword of Ice and Fire board
Song
game.
Song of Ice and Fire?
Song of Ice and Fire board game. You could pretty much take it right off the shelf and play with it, and that has a lot to say about it, I guess. Yeah. I'll leave that for Michael to cover. He does it much more better than I do. But I am interested in knowing more about this game, especially as enthusiasm will start to ramp back up again, as the idea of books coming out and shows coming back on and that kind of stuff, just as people get their idea of it. And it is a rank and file based fighting game or miniature game.
Now, there are a ton of people who really prefer that sort of thing.
Yeah, it's just weird.
They want to have that tray movement style game. And yeah, I play a couple of games with it. My favorite version of Lord of the Rings rules actually uses that, and I think it's one of the best and most functional fantasy games I've ever played.
All right, man. Okay, maybe it is now, but whenever someone would have their five wide 20 rank deep, you know, something, rats, skeletons, pikemen or whatever. And I just come in there and bust it up with like three Chaos Knights. And you got to put all those 120 models back in the box.
Listen, all right, I'm talking Lord of the Rings right now.
All right, let me do it. It's a little different. So I got my Drukhar Orc and my Warg Riders, and you've got your Shire Folk on their march to...
Listen, if I'm going to war with Shire Folk, the game's already lost. All right, just get your example game going, man.
You have the Duodarden or whatever they're called. You got some men.
Oh, it hurts. That are trotting. Someone save me.
They're trotting through the swamps of Minas Tirith. All in single file line.
And this is like one of those memes where you see like Gandalf, but it's like, you're a wizard, Luke.
And then some eagles who inexplicably just drop me off about a mile away from where I actually need to be. Then I got to trot on over there, and
Respect them eagles, man. If you do not, let me tell you this right now, full stop. You do not respect the eagles, they will not respect you.
Is that it? They just didn't respect Gandalf?
Hey man, they aren't horses, man. The eagles are a noble race, all right? The messengers of the gods. They don't have to take no guff from anybody, especially no Paul Murphy talking about the swamps of Minas Tirith.
You don't think there's any swamps around Minas Tirith?
No, Minas Tirith is not a swamp.
Pretty sure there is some swamps around Minas Tirith.
Nope.
I'm pretty sure there is.
Nope.
Man, after the show, if I pull up a map and there's swamps next to Minas Tirith, the reckoning.
I mean, if you want to talk about the dead marshes, that's not
like a swamp to you?
But it's there.
All right. Anyway, let's wrap this up, and then we'll get to the next segment with Cole Mini or not. Chris, I appreciate you rambling on with me for a good part of the show here.
Oh, man, that was fun, especially where I got to give you crap about losing to Val and blaming the cards.
Yeah. I let people know. I told him I was going to let people know he won. So yep. I've done my job.
He did. Pat on the bum. Good job, buddy.
I've done my job. All right, well, hang tight. And we're going to bring this interview with Cole Mini or not, and then we'll see everybody else next week.
Yeah, cheers, man.
See ya.
FTN is brought to you by Bell of Lost Souls. Check out www.bols.org for the best daily hobby articles on the web.
Hey, everybody, welcome to a special segment of Forge the Narrative. My name is Paul Murphy, your host. I'm joined today by Michael Chenal.
Hello, Paul.
Hey, man, how you doing?
Doing pretty good here. I mean, you know how it's like here in Georgia. The weather has been fluxing up and down. So
it's all over the place. My AC system didn't know what to do. A couple days ago, the heat was on. Now the AC's back on.
Yep. It's been great. Another day in Georgia. Global warming is fake.
Well, I think people don't always know that, but like CMON is in Atlanta, basically right in my backyard. Been here forever.
Yep. So our U.S. Office is located just right here in Alpharetta.
We're here to talk about, we've had you on before, we're here to talk about your Song of Ice and Fire miniature-based strategy game.
Yep.
Full-on tabletop war, set in that world, set in the books, anything associated with the TV show, but it based off of the books.
Yep, this is fully based on the books. We worked with George R. R. Martin to bring his world to life. So everything that we do, all the art assets, all the unit concepts, all of that is run through him to make sure that they are fitting with his vision. The way I like to describe it is, you know, we're playing in someone else's playground, so we got to obey by their rules. But we're doing the best we can to bring all of his characters to life in the way that he envisioned them.
Well, you can't go wrong with going with that source material. I mean, from the man himself, right?
Yep, that's right.
And he's also a war gamer, like, or at least a miniature collector, from what I understand.
Oh yeah, so one of the basements of one of his houses is wall to wall just miniatures. You can go on YouTube and there's several little video snippets of him completely geeking out about just his painted miniatures that he has for display there. And he actually, to my understanding, is an old school, like, historic gamer.
Man, that'd be awesome. If you put in a good word for me with him, maybe get him on the show to talk about that. That'd be awesome.
Oh, yeah, you know, just hit him on the speed dial we got here.
Hey, I don't know. Look, you might need that kind of connection to get this stuff because, I mean, the figures have been out, or at least the sculpts have been shown for this game.
But we actually have like the full production plastics. We were actually at Adepticon a few weeks ago. We had the full prototypes for our starter boxes with the final print run miniatures and everything in their full plastics that we were demoing with.
They look awesome. I mean, for instance, I know we talked about the mountain before, but all the characters fully brought to life. And, you know, I mean, can you talk about them? I know, and we've gushed about them out before because he's just such an epic character in size, you know, and in renown. But what are some of the other ones that maybe people have not seen up close that you can talk about right now?
Well, so, you know, pretty much all the major characters we have, you know, they'll appear in the game with different versions as well. So, for example, we have Jaime Lannister. The starter box comes with his Kingslayer version. At Adepticon, we actually previewed a resin of his Kingsguard version. And in the Kickstarter, you're actually getting a version of him as the maimed captive. So him with, after his spoilers for, you know, decade old book, when he got his hand cut off.
Can you tell me a little bit about the rules of the game and how the interaction between players would work? What's the scale? How many figures is what would you call? Now, I don't mean like a starter force, but like when someone builds what will be their organized play force, how many figures are they looking at? And then how does that interaction work on the table?
So each one of the units of infantry is composed of 12 models. All the cavalry are 4 models. And then you have other units that might be solo if they're like a larger size or things like that. But those are going to be your standard sizes. Now, the big push for us here is that when we're making the starter box, it is a starter box, but we want this to be complete game experience right off the bat. So we have 3 suggested game sizes, and that's 30 points, 40 points, and 50 points. But you can scale up as much as you want. We played 100-point games, and it works out just fine. But the point being is that the starter box is actually going to give you around between 34 to 36 points for each of the 2 factions in it, the Starks and the Lannisters. So you're actually going to be able to play a standard, like a small size game of 30 points and still have variety in the box to customize out your force. So you're not going to be just shoehorned into playing the same thing. You actually have variety of what you can take just in that box. And frankly, the starter box plus one other unit box of whatever you want to buy for your chosen army is going to give you enough to play what we would call a standard size game. So
if I remember right, you said unit box, like this is going to be a retail product. It's not just a Kickstarter exclusive type thing. It's going to be on the shelves. And when someone wants to buy a unit, they just buy that box and the whole unit is in that box.
Yeah.
Already assembled, right?
Exactly. So the models are all pre-assembled. They're not one-piece sculpts. It's a very big difference there. They're pre-assembled. The bodies are PVC plastic. All the weapons and anything that can be thinly or breakable is PVC plastic. And again, we've got pictures of those in really good detail up on the Kickstarter, showing them both, you know, highlighted and out in the wild at Adepticon. And then, you know, you can see the firsthand reports there to show. These are probably some of the best sculpts and miniature quality that we have put out as a company. Because, you know, we're always trying to improve on our board games and everything. But, you know, we had to take this to another level because the people are set to a different standard.
Things that that people will want to paint these and and make scenes and dioramas and stuff, like the miniatures are that good.
Oh, yeah. And so, you know, you're getting a movement tray that comes in each box. All the bases are textured and everything. But the other nice thing is that because all the units are pre-assembled and everything, if you go to a store and you see, like, man, those are the Mountainsmen. They look really bad. I want to play with them. You can just buy that box, open the box up, and boom, you're ready to play. You just put them on your tray and you're ready to go. You know, as fast as it takes you to unbox it and then put them on the tray, you're ready to play.
How are the rules going to be? Are they each in their own faction book? Is it a collection of the factions all in one book? I mean, what's the entry here for people to get?
The rule book that comes in the starter box is your full rules. It's around 40 pages with full diagrams for everything and a ton of examples because we didn't want any ambiguity. But between the rules and the unit cards, every starter box by the way comes with 2 reference cards, two copies of the reference card. The reference card is a front and back tarot-sized card that basically is the compact version of all of the rules, okay? That, combined with the unit cards, is every single thing you need to play because all the rules are fully printed on all the cards. There's no referencing anywhere else. So that's it. Between the reference card and your unit cards that you have for your actual units, that's it. If you have
Do those come with the units or do you have to purchase them separately?
Absolutely. They come with every box. So, you know, every unit has its own unit card for reference. And yes, that comes with every single unit box you purchase. Starter box comes with, you know, one for everything. That's fully it. There's no codices or army books or anything to buy. It's fully within that.
And I might have missed this a couple of minutes ago, but how many figures is that 36, 34 point army?
So the starter box comes with 4 units per side. So the Stark side, you're going to get 3 units of infantry, so 36 models there, plus 1 unit of cavalry, another 4 models, and then 1 Grey Wind, the Direwolf, who's on his own. So that's going to be, on the Stark side of things, for a small size army, if you're just talking just straight up models, in that case, you're going to be looking somewhere around 40 or so.
Okay. Yeah, I mean, I think that's a really good size. What's the suggested tabletop size to be playing this on?
40 points is our standard size game. So basically take that, add another unit of another 12 guys, and then another individual character or whatnot, which range anywhere between 3 to 5 points, and you're set. So for a standard size game, you're looking around 60 models or so spread across between 4 to 6 movement trays.
Not bad at all. And is this, you mentioned in the pre-show, I don't know if we covered this yet, but along with the release of the game, you will be recently releasing in tandem match play rules.
Yeah, so organized play is a big push for us as well, because, you know, that's an important thing for any miniatures game, at least we feel. So from day one, you're going to have organized play. We actually have released the contents of the organized play kit that will be coming out with this. And basically, you're going to get some deluxe activation tokens in the form of house banners. So in this case, it'll be Stark and Lannister. And then also we have some alternate sculpt Roose Bolton neutral faction model and cards. And basically the neutrals in the game can be hired by most every faction. You're going to get some alternate sculpts of him, and he is going to be released in a retail item. That's the one thing, is that there's never going to be any exclusive content for the game. Anything that's given away in organized play is either just going to be bling, like the activation banners, or an alternate sculpt of something that is widely available in the case of Roose Bolton.
Gotcha.
So, yeah, from day one, you can go to your local game store, say, hey, I want to play in an organized play event, assuming they've set one up, which, you know, that's something that the players, you know, need to bug their store about if they haven't, because why not? You just play in the events and you get some cool stuff. And then it's really up to the store to divvy out how they want to handle the exclusive sculpts, whether they want to make that, you know, a mini tournament and prize, or, you know, some other way to hand that out.
And is that organized play, that's the 40 points that this suggested?
Oh, the organized play can be fully handled by the store of however many points they want to run. Because this one is being released in tandem with the starter box, I assume most of those events are probably going to be at 30 points, so people can, you know, run the starter box contents right out of there.
I got it. And do you play this on a 4x6 table? Is this on a 4x4? Like, what's the suggestion?
It's played on a suggested 4x4 with the option to move up to a 4x6 if you're playing a larger size game. But frankly, a 4x4 works for most any of the standard sizes you're going to play. Really, a 4x6 is going to work if you're going to play something like, you know, 70 points or more. You know, almost double what the standard size is. Then I would move to a 4x6.
Okay, well, that's good. What factor does terrain and things of that nature play? Because I think you have some terrain along with this game. Is that right?
Oh, in the starter box, you are getting a metric ton of terrain, to be honest. So this is a larger size box than our standard board games. For those who are familiar with those, this is almost twice the length of it, and you're getting 3 punch boards worth of tokens and terrain in here. We definitely want you to have more options than fewer when it came to this. So terrain is very important in the game, because, you know, this is a positioning rank and file miniature game. Though, you know, terrain is one of those things that really affects the battlefield, and it is super important to, you know, have a diverse collection of those. So you are actually getting a large amount in the starter box, and actually, Paul, here, if you'll give me just 1 second, I can tell you the exact amount if I just pull that file up here. But you're getting a diverse thing of range of options, ranging from like stakes, corpse piles, weirwood trees, forests, bogs.
Corpse piles. All right.
Oh, yeah. Yep. There's actually one of the scenarios in the game specifically revolves around the corpse piles, that every time a unit of infantry dies, they basically get turned into a corpse pile. And the more of those you're near, it starts breaking down your morale that you have in your army.
That's, all right. That's neat.
So total in the starter box, you're getting 13 double-sided terrain pieces. You're getting 4 corpse piles, 1 forest, 1 bog, 1 weirwood tree, 3 double-sided stakes / hedges.
And these are flat cardboard tiles.
Yes, these are flat, right? These are flat 2D pieces. During the Kickstarter, we offered 3D versions. And actually, if any of your stores out there backed the Kickstarter in a retail pledge level, they have access to any of this stuff as well. So they can go and buy this as well. And we also showed a lot of this 3D terrain on our Kickstarter, and then also from Adepticon as well. So there's pictures of that out there.
Is there ever a line of sight, like, blocking factor here? Will someone only need the 2D terrain, or will they need to eventually upgrade to the 3D terrain?
No, so all the line of sight rules are handled via a keyword system on the terrain. So for example, your palisades, they have the blocks line of sight keyword. So if you try to, you know, measure line of sight through them, then it's going to be, you know, you can't do that.
I get you.
All the line of sight method is done basically, if you look at it from a top-down topographical standpoint, there's no true line of sight or anything like that. units block line of sight, certain terrain pieces block line of sight when you're trying to measure. So there's never going to be any arguments with players. You know, it's very clearly defined how that all works, because true line of sight is one of those things that, you know, you remember, Paul, back from, well, I guess, your current 40K days and those days when you used to be in team tournaments and everything, how, you know, how that can get.
Well, it's as long as, you know, there's a way of handling, I'm just curious as to how the game played out. And, you know, 2D terrain, it's easy to switch out the tabletops, that's for sure.
Yeah, and the thing is, so a lot of our terrain also, because of the nature of it, if you have the 3D version, for example, we have stakes. So those have the destructible keyword. So if a unit moves over them, they actually are destroyed and removed from the battlefield, and the unit that moves on top is going to suffer some negative effects. But you do have like terrain that can actually like get shaped across the battlefield. One of the game modes is actually a siege scenario. It's the Storm of Swords game mode, where you have a defender who is defending their castle, and you have three big castle wall terrain pieces. And so that game mode is all about one person's the attacker, one person's the defender. The defender is just trying to last six rounds to outlast the attacker's onslaught before their battlements are destroyed.
And are these things that are like suggested tournament type missions, or is these just are more for narrative or play replicating battles in the books?
So we have five different game modes that are included in the game. For our tournament system and everything, it's basically recommended that you can play any of them that you want. And they're also all functional for multiplayer as well, except for the Storm of Swords one I just mentioned. That one's better off two-player. But all the others can be played with multiple players if you so choose. And we will have a full, like, you know, tournament rule kit and everything that will come out shortly after release as well.
I like the sound of that. So all the factions, what are the various factions that people can get on day one?
On day one, we have the Starks and Lannisters. Those are our two initial factions. Those are the ones that we also introduced in the Kickstarter. And then we have the Neutral Forces, which currently are represented by House Bolton, also in the Kickstarter. The thing about the Kickstarter that was different from a lot of the ones we did is that we, again, from day one, wanted this game to have a big retail push. So the Kickstarter was a very limited amount of offering. You know, here's the foundation of this game. Everything else is supported through retail, so you're going to need to get through your retail stores. But we do have plans that within the first, you know, 3 months of the game being released in retail, you're already going to see new factions. Now, we haven't really talked about them too much. We've been dropping some spoilers here and there with, you know, a few various art pieces and a few miniatures that we've been showing across conventions, but we haven't said anything. So, you know, I'm not going to break that just yet and say anything, but again, we have two more factions scheduled to be released almost immediately after launch.
And the reason I ask is, you know, this is one of the properties that people can get emotional attached to certain factions and families. Just curious as to when they'll be represented.
Well, I mean, the number one question since hell day negative one was, you know, oh, when are we gonna see dragons? And I swear we could have funded the next three books being written if I had a dollar for every time I was asked that. But as we have kind of adapted our motto, if it's in the books, it can be in the game. And I will just say that, you know, it is a fairly safe bet to think that probably the most iconic aspect of the entire series is probably going to work its way into the game somehow.
Well, oh, sure. Yeah, and I can imagine that there'd also be special scenarios around that kind of stuff. But I think at the core of what the game is, if I'm picking up what you're putting down, is that it's a battle. It's an army fighting an army.
Yes. And that's one of the things that people always ask, well, you know, how are you going to handle full-size grown-up dragons? And I will answer that by saying the same way that armies handle them in the books.
Not well?
Not well.
No, I'm kidding, of course. So, but,
well, that's the thing. Like, again, you're basically asking, you know, okay, well, what do I do against an atom bomb? You're right. What do you do against an atom bomb?
I don't want to put the cart before the horse. I mean, I think that the game has a good bit of interesting sure. things just with this level of, I guess, unit-on-unit type combat.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, we might have jumped over it too, but like, how does the game work? How does one deploy their forces? How do you defeat your opponent? Like, what are the core mechanics here?
All right. So as I had said previously, we have five different game modes, and each of those are going to lay out your victory conditions. So it's never going to be a matter of just going in there and killing all your opponent's guys. That's going to help you win the game, but it's not going to be how you win the game. Each of the game modes outlays different victory conditions, but basically, you're going to have your units. You'll deploy them based on the game mode that you're playing in various configurations. Usually, it's going to be, you know, somewhere on my side of the table, and then you have your deployment area, and they're going to start moving around the board. you know, again, this is, it's rank and file stuff. I mean, I'm not going to say that's anything, you know, new or, you know, innovative. It's just, it is what it is. But the big thing is that, you know, so you've got your units and everything is actually based on the remaining ranks in your units. Each infantry unit has three ranks consisting of four models each. And so while the individual models in a unit comprise the health of the unit, as you start losing ranks, your effectiveness in the unit is going to start deteriorating. So if you have three ranks, you know, your attack is going to be the strongest it can be. When you get knocked down to two ranks, then it's going to be a little bit weaker. When you get knocked down to one rank, it's going to be, you know, your unit's almost broken and almost going to flee. So, you know, it's not going to be playing that well. While this is all going on, you have a deck of tactics that is unique to your faction. It is also modified by your army commander, which is a powerful individual that you have chosen to lead your forces. And I say powerful not in necessarily the physical sense, because in the setting, you know, okay, you've got the mountain. He's a big scary guy. He can probably kill like four or five guys on his own, but if 10 guys come after him, they're just going to kill him. You know, people are not that resilient. This is not Hero Hammer, for lack of a better word. So you're taking your commander for their strategy and tactics. And so they're going to modify your tactics deck by putting in some of their own special cards. So each of your turns, you'll have a number of cards in your hand that are basically the tactics that your army employs, not just your commander, but also your chosen faction. So you've got your unit abilities that are going on. So, you know, I might have a unit that's really fast, very skirmishy, but doesn't have a lot of armor. I might have a big tanky unit, you know, your standard tropes and things like that. But on top of that, I've got my tactics cards coming from my commander and my overall army, which is going to change how I play. Just by switching out my commander, it can drastically change how my army plays, even if I'm playing the exact same units. For example, if I have the Starks, and I've got an army that is led by Robb Stark. So he is all about mobility, positioning, doing flanking tactics, hit and run type of stuff. That army is going to play very differently than one run by, say, Great John Umber, who is the leader of House Umber, and these are all the grizzly kind of mountain men style guys. They're all about berserker tactics, so they're going to get stronger as they take damage. So even if I just take the same exact units and I switch out my commanders, the different tactics cards that those are going to configure my deck into are going to change how my army plays, because one of them is going to be very swift, it's going to be very maneuverable. The other one is going to be not as swift, not as maneuverable, but if you damage them, they're going to damage you back, and they're probably going to end up getting stronger as they suffer damage. And so while all that is going on, you also have the tactics board, and that represents the off-battlefield political nature of the game and the setting in general, because that was one of the most important aspects of, you know, just the books. You know, more people die off-battlefield than they do combined on the battlefield by the books.
I gotcha. And is that how you handle more of the characters that have what I would consider no combat potential?
Exactly. So you have a tactics board off to the side of the battlefield. And so I should mention the game is alternating activations. I'm going to pick a unit and activate, you're going to pick a unit and activate, and we're going to go back and forth in the round until everything is done. Part of the units that I can buy in my army are my non-combat characters. It's like Cersei Lannister or, you know, Sansa and Catelyn Stark. There are also some non-combat versions of combat characters, like Ned Stark has a combat version, he's got a non-combat version. But as part of my activations, these guys can move on to the tactics board, and there's five different zones that they can vie for control over. And for controlling these zones, they're going to give me beneficial effects that are going to affect the flow of combat, whether that ranges from healing up my my combat units via hiring on reinforcements, or, you know, causing panic in enemy forces via intimidation tactics or things like that, or even allowing me to draw additional tactics cards and things as, you know, they're doing strategic planning. In addition to this, all those non-combat guys will have additional powers of their own that might influence the battlefield as well. So, for example, Cersei. I'll use one of my favorite examples. So Tyrion, for taking him in my army, he is going to increase my tactics hand size because he's way smarter than you, right? And he also has a certain number of times per game he can force your opponent to start discarding their tactics cards.
Oh, okay.
And then you've got guys like Varys. Varys has the ability to actually, he's basically like a counterspell. He starts shutting down enemy tactics and political effects. So you take him if, you know, you just want to run a control style army.
Okay, so I'm starting to see how this call plays out, how your commander is gives character and personality to your army, even above beyond what they have, like, on the sculpted on the figure and whatnot.
Right.
Okay. I like it. So, with the deck itself, is that something that you construct, or is it you just get the deck for the faction? How is this modular?
Your deck is consisting of 14 faction-specific cards, 7 cards with 2 duplicates, and then it's adding 6 cards into your deck based on the commander you've chosen. So if I'm running, you know, Ned Stark, he's going to give me 3 cards with 2 copies each that are shuffled into that deck. So the commander that you choose is making up a full third of your overall army tactics. So flipping the other side of the coin here, let's look at the Lannisters. If I take Jaime Lannister as my commander, that army is going to be very focused on counterattacks and basically punishing the opponent for failing in what they're going to do. So he's got, you know, Deadly Riposte, Expert Parry, all these things that are going to help you survive attacks and then deal extra damage on the counterattack. If I switch out Jaime for the Mountain, all of a sudden my army is going to become much more focused on charging and overrunning the enemy and just more raw aggression. So that right there is just showing a really quick change just by switching out your commander, you know, how you're going to have a completely different play style, even in the same faction.
That's kind of neat. So the game is, we keep saying it's coming out soon, but when can people expect to get this in their hands and it start to appear on the shelves at retail stores?
August is when we're looking right now. That's when you'll be able to go pick it up and, you know, start playing.
To be fair, I think that's a slight delay from the last time we talked.
Yeah, so when our Kickstarter, our estimated projection was April. Unfortunately, we had a delay that set us back some time, and our current projections are on August. But we're fairly confident that that's going to be hit.
Well, what's the website that people can find this?
That'll be on our Kickstarter. If you look there, just look up Song of Ice and Fire on Kickstarter, or you can check us out on Facebook as well, Song of Ice and Fire Tabletop Miniature Game.
And then what is the expected retail price for the game if someone has it already in on the Kickstarter right now?
The starter box for Stark versus Lannisters is $150. That's getting you 2 armies and 103 miniatures total.
Yeah, that's pretty cool. I hope it's okay if I check back in with you as this starts to come out, and especially when you get your organized play pack and something we can talk about. And
even the stuff I can't talk about right now, I just really want to talk about. But
you know, soon. I'm looking forward to seeing how it progresses, man.
Yep. Well, actually, we can probably get some live plays in there, Mr. Murphy, if you want. I mean, again, we're both down the street from each other.
That would be neat. I mean, I would love to. This is this is a very popular style of moving miniatures around. And I think it's a different level of tactics, and love to exercise that brain with that, or that part of the brain with this, really cool story behind it.
Well, you know, I've always liked to rank and file miniature games. You know, I'm an old school, you know, Warhammer player, but the whole point of this one here was just we wanted to kind of modernize it a bit because, you know, the old style rank and files, you know, not even just talking about Warhammer, but just the old historical ones and things like that. It's just a natural progression of, you know, people's time these days. Because, for example, one of the big things is that each of these games, even if you're playing a larger size game, it's going to probably take you about an hour or less. But that was a very important thing because, yeah, you remember the old days, you know, you could be playing for 3-4 plus hours on these and still not really be done
the whole night.
And just no one has
time. I don't mind that either, though. I like all types.
Yes, but I would much rather get a few good games in than just one okay game or even one decent game, to be honest.
I'm glad you brought that up because I had not even thought to ask just how long it would take to play a full game.
Yeah, you know, it's actually one of those things that it's actually a pretty big point to bring up, the fact that the game does move very quickly. And it's just, you know, it's that expectation that people have when they hear, you know, oh, rank and file or even tabletop miniature games these days. They just think that I have to devote a couple hour block at minimal to this. And that's just not the case here. You know, the first time you're playing through, yeah, it might take you a couple hours because you're getting rules and everything. But I'm fully confident if you and your opponent both know what you're doing, you can complete any of these game modes with a standard size game in an hour or less.
Man, that's pretty cool. Well, Michael, thanks a lot for coming on and talking with me. And I will be trying to catch up with you very soon, either to get my hands on, play the game, or to get you back on and talk about things as we get closer to launch.
All right, Paul. As always, it's a pleasure.
Have a good night.
Yep. Take care, man.